पार्थाय प्रतिबोधितां भगवता नारायणेन स्वयं व्यासेन कथितां पुराणमुनिना मध्ये महाभारतम् तद्वैतामृतवर्षिणीं भगवतीं अष्टादशाध्यायिनीम् अम्ब त्वामनुसन्धदामि भगवद्गीते भवद्वेष्मी.
Verse 11.
Ye yatha mam prapadyante.
Tans tathaiva pajamyaham. Mama varatmanu varatante.
Manushyah partha sarvashah.
Ye yatha mam prapadyante tan tatha eva vajami aham mama vartma anuvartante manushyah partha sarvashah.
If you remember from the previous verse, really talked about the person who really was an adhikari for this knowledge and who gained this knowledge completely. You recall the verse, it goes, Vita Raga Bhaya Krodaha. Those people that are free from Raga Dvesha Bhaya Kroda, fear and anger, they're completely free from these things. Manmayaha, for them really everything is myself. They are myself alone, manmayaha. They are me, right? Manmayaha. And those people, mam upashritaha, they are resolved in me. They are surrendered to me. All they see is me, right? So that's all they see. Everything is Ishvara. They are myself alone. And then he says, the next time he says, many people are like this, bahavaha, purified by knowledge. Means all the raga dvesha, all of the likes and dislikes, the ajnana, you know, avidya kama karma, all the avidya, all of the ignorance, all of the raga dveshas, likes and dislikes, and all of the bhaya, all of the fear and the krodha that comes rolling out of that avidya. So that is all purified by knowledge. Because jnanam removes the avidya. Knowledge removes the ignorance. The ignorance is removed, then its effects of kama and bhaya and krodha, desire and anger and fear, all of these things are released. You're released from these things. And so now Krishna says, many people purified by the tapas of knowledge, mudbhavam agataha, they come to my being. Means they attain me. Attain me through knowledge. Not attain me as in terms of a place. But obtain me through the recognition of that I am them. That they are me. Through the Mahavakya. That recognition that the being that I am is Ishvara. So in that way, that many people, so as he's talking to Arjuna, remember, many people have gained this. Now Arjuna thinks, well, what about all the other people? You created this. You created the creation. If this is all your, this is all your creation. Why don't you make it so that everybody desires you and not just these people? Right? Why isn't everybody a mumukshu? Why don't all of the people come to you in this way? You know? Why just some of them? Even many, there's many who aren't. Who don't. So that's Arjuna's doubt, as according to Shankara. So Krishna says, he looks at it much differently, and in a beautiful way. He says, "Ye yata mam prapadyante," in whatever way they worship me, they come to me. In whatever way they seek me, in whatever way they worship me. "Ye yata mam prapadyante, tan tata eva bhajamyaham." I bless them in that way itself. So in whatever way they worship me, in that way I come to them. In that way I bless them. And he says, "Mama vartma anuvartante manushaha he partha sarvashaha." Manushaha, all people, all manushas, all beings, all human beings, are anuvartante, following mama vartma, my path alone. All of them. All of them are seeking me alone. All of them are coming after me alone. Right? But in sarvashaha, in many, many different ways. So all of them are seeking me, but they're seeking me, they're following me. Anuvartante means they're following after me. My path. But sarvashaha in many, many different ways. Okay. And so, you'll see, and he has another verse after this, we'll do that in a minute, that continues on. That's why Swamiji, you know, as I've said so many times, but he started really talking about understanding Ishwara as understanding the whole manifest knowledge, this whole creation of manifest knowledge, as an infinite order. Now, the entire creation is Ishwara. Right? This is Ishwara's body. This is the whole infinite manifestation of the creation is one being, is Ishwara. So every part of this creation is Ishwara. And every part of this creation, on subtle levels and physical level, is held together by an infinite manifestation of laws. And we learn in science, just to gravity, mt squared, math. We see, just on a physical level, that this is all one cohesive whole being held together by an infinite structure of laws. And we understand it, too, even in terms of our own psyche and in terms of our psychology, that there are laws, dharma, adharma, and the effects of dharma and adharma. We see there's a kind of a natural order that our psychology follows. That's why we can have psychology as a science. That's why we can understand when we see somebody's emotions, an expression on their face of sadness or happiness or joy or agitation. We recognize it. We recognize it in their body language. Because? Why? Because there's an order. There's an order on a subtle level, on a psychological level, on an emotional level, you know, on a physical level, on every level imaginable. Every level imaginable is part of one infinite being. So now, here we are, this is Ishwara, and we are seeking Ishwara. So when Swamiji does the bhasha on this, he's talking about it in many, many different ways. We are seeking Ishwara in everything that we desire. Every single thing that we seek, everything that we seek, we are seeking Ishwara in that form. And what do we receive from the way that we seek it, the way that we seek that thing? We receive the karmapala. And that is Ishwara's coming to us. See what I mean? So it goes way beyond. We can worship Ishwara in the form of any of the devatas or in any religion. You can worship Ishwara in terms of a god, say you want to. You worship Ishwara in the form of Krishna. You know? Or you're a Muslim and you worship Ishwara, and you worship Ishwara in the form of the Quran. Or you worship Ishwara in the form of Jesus or the Holy Trinity. These are all ways of worshiping Ishwara as a devata, in a sense. Right? But we also worship Ishwara in terms of all of our desires, everything that we go after. Right? I want this so that I can be happy. I want this so that I can be happy. I want this so that I can be happy. We'll see in the next verse, we also worship devatas different forms of God so that I can have this, so that I can be happy. It becomes complex. I worship God so that God will give me this thing which I want. So that's once removed. Very few just worship me, as we'll see. Just worship me as Ishwara. That's so Krishna's now talking as Ishwara. Very few, it's not that they worship me in whatever thing they're doing, and I always come to them. I always respond because I am the whole. So every response is my response. So when, in whatever way you seek me, in whatever way you reach out to me, whatever part of me you think I am, that way, in that way I'm responding to you. Because in fact it is me. But what you're doing is you're seeking, and where your heart is, what you're actually seeking for your wholeness is a part of me. And so I satisfy you with that part. And that is the situation for most people. They're seeking a part of me. All of it is me. And then I give you that part. And so I'm not, as Shankara unfolds this, it's not that I'm have preferences. I don't have preferences. I respond to you, to what you ask of me. In that way I respond to you. It's just that there are not very many people who seek me, the whole, who want to know who I am, rather than wanting to have something within the creation that I can bless them. You see what I mean? So even with the devatas, I pray to the devatas, or I pray even to Ishwara, the God of all, the one God, Ishwara, of which all of the devatas are a part. I pray to Ishwara, but not to know Ishwara. I pray to Ishwara so that I can have this. And so Ishwara answers my prayer with that. Or forget, even knowing that there's an Ishwara, I still pray to this. I make every effort to attain this. And even though I don't know it's Ishwara, that doesn't mean it isn't Ishwara. And so Ishwara, whether I know it's Ishwara or not, Ishwara still responds. You know? And so he says, in whatever form you seek me, in whatever form you come to me, in that form I give to you, in that form I bless you. I don't see that there is anyone who's not following me, who's not coming to me, who's not following me, because I'm the whole. It's just sarvashaha. It is done in an infinity of ways, right? Because there's nothing out here that is not me. And so it's not a matter at all of preferences. It's just a matter of your own desire. What say if your desire was for me? Then that's what I give you. That's also why, you know, in this tradition, where a mumukshu, a person who is a mumukshu, right, is the person who's recognized that this object or this object, you know, I used to pray to the Lord, let me have this, and let me have this, let me have this, thinking that that would solve the problem. At some point I realize that I don't want this or that or that. I want to know the truth. I want to know the whole. I seek the Lord at that time. When a person really becomes a mumukshu, the prayer would be more like, instead of let me have this, it would be more like, you know, God, please save me. Tell me what is going on. What is the reality? What is the truth? Please help me with knowledge. Prayer becomes one for knowledge and one for understanding. So that person is seeking to know, right? Because they realize that even though I'm fulfilling all of these desires aren't going to resolve into anything that is helpful to me in the long run. How many lifetimes does it take to figure this out? You know, really, when you think about it, when you go back, you think, okay, this lifetime, how many lifetimes before this one have I had? Infinite. Beginningless. That's how tricky the problem is, you know? Because, it's what she's going to address in the next verse, because we see
It's so easy for us, just as human beings, to try to fulfill our desires in the world. If there is an object, I project my happiness onto it, and then let me have that. That would make me happy. It's so easy. That's what we're trained to do. We all know about this, you know. And so that's where the pravritti is, that pravritti and nivritti. Nivritti means I go away from, that doesn't make me happy. I go away from it. I don't even think about it. It's so natural. That makes me happy. I go toward it. We're all just running around. It's kind of like a, you know, when they say moths going toward the light. We are always going toward the light. That's another way of thinking. We're always going toward Ishwara. It's just we're deluded. If we're always going toward what we think will give us that wholeness, that completeness, that wholeness and completeness where you say, all is well with me. All is fine. I've realized I've been a success in my life. Yeah. That's what it amounts to, right? I have done what there is to be done. I've accomplished what is to be accomplished. In fact, when they say, you know, well, the idea for moksha is praptasya praptahi, the attainment of the already attained. But what is it? What does that feel like when that praptasya praptahi? I've attained. We say, I've gained what is to be gained. I've done what is to be done. The buddhi is called alam buddhi. Means it's enough. I have what I need. I am complete. I am whole. That's what everybody is seeking, to be able to say that. But we think what's easiest for us is to fill this desire and fulfill this desire and fulfill this desire and fulfill this desire. You know, and pray to God that He will let us have all of these things that we're seeking, because if we got this proper collection of things around us, then, and could maintain them, of course we have to pray for the maintenance also, you know, then all would be well and I would have accomplished what there is to accomplish. But at some point, a person becomes a mumuksha, they realize that it's not going to work. Because there's everything is in constant flux. And at that time, you start seeking the Lord Himself. That's when a person really becomes a mumuksha. But then the Bhagavan says, you know, very few people seek me to know me, Shankara, to know me. But they seek me nevertheless. Right? They seek me nevertheless, because whatever you're seeking in the creation is me. So he says a little more here. It goes, explain a little further. Kaṅkṣanta karmanām siddhim, kaṅkṣanta karmanām siddhim, yajanta iha devatāha, yajanta iha devatāha, kṣipram himānuṣe loke, Chitram himanushe loke, siddhir bhavati karmaja, siddhir bhavati karmaja. Kaṅkṣantaḥ karmanām siddhim yajante iha devatāha. Chitram hi manushe loke, siddhir bhavati karmaja. Again, the wonder is for Arjuna, you know, but still, why? Why are they seeking? Why is a person drawn out to fulfill desires, you know, rather than seeking you? And so he says, Kaṅkṣantaḥ karmanām siddhim. These people desiring the results of karma, karmanām siddhim, kaṅkṣantaḥ, desiring the siddhi, desiring to accomplish karma, the karma phala, desiring the results of their action, yajante iha devatāha. Here in this world, yajante, they worship the devatas, accusative plural, devatāha. Here in this world, they worship all of the devatas, whatever's a devatā to them. Okay, these two verses that I'm doing kind of go together. desiring what? The results of their karma. I do an action because I want a result. That's why I do the action. So desiring that result, they worship all of the devatas. Different devatas, you can say, like for instance, you can take devatas like this, like I'll worship, you know, Ganesha to remove all obstacles. Or I'll worship Saraswati to help me with my knowledge and with my my skills in the arts. I'll worship Lakshmi because if I'm doing the stocks, I want her to help me make them successful. So I can worship all kinds of gods, and even in all of the different religions, say in Christianity, there's so many saints, right, that are worshipped, even so that I can get a parking place. to give me a parking place or to protect me while I'm traveling, all of these type of things. We're evoking the gods, we're invoking God in all of these different forms to help me get the result of my karma. And he says, why? Because why do people go this way? He says, kshipram heat, because manushe loke, in this human world, right? Siddhihi bhavati karmaja. He says, the accomplishments, the pala, that is karmaja, that is born of karma, is kshipram. It comes quickly, right? It comes quickly. It's easy to get. That's how, because our whole world is like that. The result is you go after an object, right? And then you do everything you can to get the object. You get the object, and then you have a moment of happiness. That's what it is. That's how we operate. All of our desires are like that. You go after the object. If you're religious, you can pray to Bhagavan or to a devata to help you, you know, to get that. And then you get the pala, you get your happiness. That's it. Right? We do it all the time. We get the happiness, that's it. We get the happiness, that's it. We get the happiness, that's it. The problem is that the happiness is like this. Sukha, dukkha. Sukha, dukkha. Sukha, dukkha. And that goes on and on and on. So what we find is that we do get the happiness. We do get the happiness, but it's very short-lived. But we do get it. And we know how to get it, right? You know what to do, right? Like you can go and get an ice cream, you know, or you can veg out on the couch and listen to music, or you can call a friend, or take a walk in nature, you know, or go shopping. I mean, or do yoga, you know. There are so many things that you have learned to do to kind of relieve yourself of stress and have a moment of happiness. You kind of know the ropes. And so you know how to do that. You know how to get these moments of happiness. And you become more and more skilled in learning how to get more moments of happiness and to also avoid painful situations. We become more and more skilled. You even in your learning of Dharma, your understanding of Dharma, how important that is to having moments of happiness. Dharma also has its karma pala. Just Dharma, that attitude, has its pala. The pala is shanti. You know? So the way we behave in the world, we do an action the way we do the action. We learn also that gives us shanti. That gives us peace. But all of these things that are born of, all the things that are born of karma, these things we know how to do, and we can always, when one fails, we can move to the next. This is exactly samsara, right? What happens when I realize that these things are not going to give me what I'm seeking? Now, that's not so easy. Because my mind continues to go out to these objects to quickly satisfy myself so that I can have the moment of happiness. That's how we live. What about when when I no longer know, when I know that that doesn't, it's kind of the dark night of the soul, I know that that is okay. It does work, but it does this give this immediate satisfaction? The fulfillment of a desire gives an immediate satisfaction. I do know that. But I also know that I would like to be whole and complete and one with Bhagavan. Blessed by Bhagavan. One with Bhagavan. So as a whole and complete person, one with the Lord, I then experience this creation. That's what we all really want. In fact, if you read all of the scriptures and psalms and things like this, they're all saying what we all seek. And how many people have heard just, it's union with God. All of the religions say, I want union with God. I want to be one with the Lord. It's a natural striving. And that natural striving means really that all is completely well with me because I'm held by God and protected by God. There isn't any duality between me and God. There's a union with God. And in Vedanta, it resolves in the fact, in the recognition that all of this is nothing but God. Right? That all of this is nothing but Ishwar. There's a resolution there. But now look. When you come to that understanding, it's now not a matter of quickly doing a karma to quickly obtain the result. It's not a matter of that anymore. That will still work to give you an immediate result, which is fraught with dukkha. And that's what you've realized. Right? The result that you're seeking, if it's in an object in the world or something that exists within time and space, if that thing you're seeking, that little piece of Bhagavan you're seeking, you will get a moment of happiness, but it's fraught with pain because that thing that you're seeking is time-bound and so are you. And so even though you'll have a moment of happiness, it's riddled with the pain of its temporariness. Okay, so say now. You realize that you're not seeking that anymore. It's fine, it's there, it's going to always be there, but that is not what I'm seeking. Now it's not kshipram. It's not so quick. Right? In fact, it has nothing to do with being quick or long. It's not quick, it's not long, it's none of those things. Because it's a matter now of recognize, it's a matter like this, it's a matter of recognizing the fact of it. Removing the ignorance and recognizing the fact of myself, recognizing in fact I am Ishwara. But now the mind that has had limitless, beginningless lifetimes, dealing with the world as I need this and then I'll be happy. So quick fix. The mind is still doing that. It's not like all of a sudden you become a mumukshu, you realize that none of this works, and the mind just goes, oh, none of this works. Right? You realize this doesn't work, and then you keep doing it. You realize there's no ananda in it. It's not going to make me happy. In fact, it really just makes me miserable. Then why am I still seeking it? Then you say, yeah, why am I still seeking it? That's a good question. You know? But the fact is that I am still seeking it because I'm still seeking this to make me happy and this to make me happy. And we all have the little set, you know, of those things because of conditioning and conditioning and conditioning and conditioning. And so this now is requires some unwinding. It's not quick. In a sense, the knowledge is quick. Your knowledge is quick. It's quick when the knowledge is there, the knowledge is there. And then you see it more clearly, then that's quick. Then you see that more clearly, and that's quick. And then you see that more clearly, and that's quick. You see what I mean? Every time you see, it's instant. You see, but then you see more clearly, and that's instant. You see more clearly, and that's instant. But the mind has to be held in that knowledge. You know, the buddhi gains this knowledge, the mind has to be held in that knowledge for quite some time, right? Until what? until I appreciate this, that out of my ananda, out of my ananda, the source of ananda, I appreciate Ishwara. And I appreciate Ishwara in this form, and 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 in this form. I appreciate Ishwara. I appreciate my desires, the desires that are born out of Prarabdha. I appreciate my life, the life that's an expression of the very karmas that caused me to take this birth. I appreciate my emotions, you know. But I appreciate them all as Ishwara. It's very, very different. Right? It's not that everything goes flat and you don't have likes and dislikes, but you're not asking Ishwara to be, you're not asking the world, an object in the world to be Ishwara. You're allowing Ishwara to be Ishwara. Do you see the difference? I don't know how clear I'm being. We ask objects in the world to be Ishwara. Because when we go after an object, we want wholeness and completeness through that object. Right? And so we're always looking for that union through this object or this situation or this situation. Or we're looking for that union in terms of my mind being in a particular way or so many things. It doesn't matter what it is. But that's so much different than when my mind, my buddhi, is actually appreciating whatever situation is there as Ishwara. Not one thing, but the whole thing. Now, say if you say that, not one thing, but the whole thing. What is included in that? Not just this physical world that I perceive, but absolutely everything that is going on internally and externally. That means appreciating the moods and the emotions and the thoughts that are going on in my mind. And seeing, this is what I was telling you last week about the meditations that Swamiji was doing on the order. Trying to understand the order of your psychology. You know, say for instance, when you see, say a mood rises. If somebody hurts your feelings, somebody does something, you feel hurt. Say that's a hurt mood rises. That's part of Ishwara. That hurt is an experience that is very connected to a whole network of events. So-and-so looked at me cross-eyed, and the reason they looked at me cross-eyed with some annoyance is because this had happened, because that had happened, because this had happened, because that had happened, and this is the result. This is the karmapala that happened out of that network of events. And so say when you're experiencing something externally and inwardly, internally also, you're experiencing Ishwara. You're experiencing the karmapala of Ishwara, of all that's going on as kind of a unified whole. And so what happens to your attitude when you have that sort of relaxation that allows all of this to be? All of this that's going on inside to be interested in it as this is Ishwara. The thing about that is that when you allow it to be and see the interconnectedness of it, allow it to be Ishwara, there's a vairagya that takes place. This is actually what we call vairagya. Vairagya is often translated as dispassion. But dispassion has a negative, I don't care about you, you know, I don't want you type of attitude. That isn't vairagya. Vairagya, that dispassion means I can allow it to be. I don't need it to go away. I don't need it to be there, and I don't need it to go away. I allow it to be. If I allow it to be, then the ananda, which is the swarup ananda of myself, is really in no way the states of mind are in no way competing with my own shanti, the shanti of the self. The shanti of the self is natural. It's always there. It's just like, for instance, you hear those bells? How I can say those bells are taking place in the silence of my being. Or you couldn't hear them otherwise. That silence is always there. That silence is Shanti. Right? That's your very self, your very being. That Shanti, that being is never, never disturbed by anything. It wouldn't even matter if your mind was all agitated and upset. But the problem is, for the mind, when the mind's all agitated and upset, and I'm hurting and running around and doing this and that, it doesn't often feel like recognizing, you know, it's that pervasive presence of myself. It gets lost in itself. But now say your buddhi has a way of being with all of the things that go on with the creation and all of the things that go on inside of you. Once you recognize it as Ishwara, you recognize it as part of the greater order. Part of the greater order is your own upbringing. You know? All of the traumas we underwent because of our poor parents. All of the trauma of growing, all of those traumas of growing up, you know? All of the trauma, that's all part of the order. They've produced those traumas that they bestowed upon you were the result of traumas bestowed upon them, and it goes on and on and on and on. That's one net. It's one big network, and so now you're the carrier of that. And then the question is, with you, with your buddhi, with your knowledge, you're the carrier of those traumas. Are you able to transform them? You know, at some point, that antakarana shuddhi comes into play. At some point, a person becomes a good parent. You know, just think for yourself, especially those of your parents or have nieces or nephews. You either, if you're not very conscious, do to your children what your parents did to you. Mm-hmm. That's an unconscious. That's why these things can, these abuses can go from generation to generation to generation. But a conscious person usually overcompensates to make sure that their child doesn't experience those things that were hurtful. They make every effort to protect their child from the things that hurt them. That's kind of a natural healing, and so that kind of breaks the lineage, the trauma lineage, when a parent becomes like that. Then they're always working on themselves in that way. But internally also, we become, once we gain a buddhi that has knowledge, we break that lineage. We have to break it. We can break it in ourselves also, not just for our child or for the people that we know. We can break it internally by reparenting those parts that have been damaged. We're transforming those, that trauma. But to do that, there needs a certain level of consciousness. Right? And one of the, from the knowledge standpoint, besides in the inner child work, this is all so helpful, talking to all of the different parts of time inside, but also from a knowledge standpoint, to understand the complexity of all of our feelings and all of our traumas, the complexity, the generational complexity. Even in this room, all of our relationships, we all have, it's very complex. Everybody's relationship with everybody else is completely different. Right? And then if we were to really go into it, and it goes on infinitely. It would probably cover the whole universe. And then go back in time for, you know, seven generations, as they say. That's the complexity of it. And so that complexity can be, is once you understand it or become aware of it, you objectify that complexity in terms, and you, it allows you to objectify your feelings and your life and your situation and the people, the whole nexus of people, you know? And it just gives you, you see it like this. It gives you, if you understand it all as Ishwara, you can then give it to Ishwara. because it's his anyway. So you can give all of that over, and in giving all of that over to Ishwara, to understanding it as part of that complexity, then you become free of it. See what I mean? You become, you're, and what does it mean to become free of it? It doesn't really mean that it's not there. Because the world is what it is. The mind is what it is. But the thing is when you have that, can give that over to Ishwara, kind of understanding it as part of the order, what happens is that in spite of the experience, the shanti of yourself is a bright light. The shanti of yourself is obviously pervading. It is anyway, but this now it becomes very, very clear, is obviously pervading and present to the experience because the mind isn't agitated. Experience can be anything. Yeah? But once you accept the experience, the one who's accepting the experience isn't agitated. Now say the mind is agitated, but then you objectify the agitation and see it as part of the whole order, everything that's connected to that, you objectify it. Then there's the agitation, but you're not agitated. So what's happening is that you start, as you start having, are like this, yourself, which is never agitated at any time, yourself that is never not shanti, that's who you are, that's what you are, that becomes predominant. Right? It's like the substance, the being, becomes predominant, not the mitya. The satyam becomes predominant, not the mitya. Right? But that becomes like that because you've allowed the mitya. By the mitya, I mean your mind, your thoughts, your experiences, the whole upadhi, the whole maya upadhi of Ishwara. You allow that to be. And so as this... This at first requires, you know, bringing your mind back because your mind is used to going out and quickly fulfilling the desire so you can have a moment of happiness. That's what it's used to, even though it doesn't work. And so what happens is, as this, you become, once you start understanding, recognizing yourself and recognizing Ishwara, when your mind goes out to fulfill a desire, it can do that because how could we live otherwise? What if I had a desire for a glass of water? What am I going to do? Say, oh, that's a desire. I'm not going to fulfill it. It's not that. If there's nothing in me that takes that as my source of ananda. Out of ananda, I go and get the glass of water. Not for ananda. I get the glass of water for water. Not for ananda. I do the actions in order to get the result, whatever that result is. But I don't confuse my ananda with the result. See? It's, and all of this takes, you know, it takes time. It takes time for vairagya to blossom. Jnana, knowledge, and vairagya are the same. Jnana nishtha, in fact, as I forget the text that's where Shankara talks about this. Jnana, knowledge, and vairagya go together. Right? Because you can't have vairagya without knowledge. Because it's like saying, you know, no, I don't need anything to be happy. You don't know yourself as ananda. You know, but you don't need anything. I mean, what we, to be whole, is to recognize my own nature. My own nature is ananda. Right? Swarupa ananda. And so if I don't recognize that, then I need this. If I recognize this, I don't need this. That doesn't mean I don't enjoy it or that my prarabdha, I'm not going after it or anything. It doesn't mean that. It means that I don't need it. Like I don't need a wonderful helium balloon. that I'm carrying. I don't need it, I enjoy it. But if the balloon breaks loose and it goes, then I can enjoy that, that's fine. It was here and now it's gone. That's it. There's nothing more to it. And it's not that you don't enjoy it when it's here, but when it's gone, it's gone. It's like blinking. It doesn't make it nothing, you know. It doesn't matter. Now, that maturity of that vairagya comes as my mind totally assimilates this knowledge. It's a maturity. And as my mind assimilates this knowledge, that vairagya is natural. The vairagya just means, you know, that I'm not shaken by the way the world is. I'm not shaken by the way my mind is. I'm not asking it, you know, to be different. If the mind is upset, then I'm there trying to help. Another person is upset, and they're trying to help. If the mind is tired, I'm trying to give it some rest. It is, it's whatever it is. If the mind is hurt for whatever reason, I see what all of that is, and I try to comfort it. It's a very simple. It's very, very simple. You know, but that simplicity has a direct relationship to vairagya. You know, being vairagya means I accept things as they are. I accept things as they are because I'm whole and complete. If you can say, yes, I accept things as they are. Why? Because I'm all that there is. Because I'm Ishvara, I can accept things as they are. If I can't say I'm Ishvara, that this is all my being, how can I accept things as they are? Because then I'm a limited being within this creation. I'm either the whole, you know, or what? I'm the whole, or I'm not the whole. If I'm not the whole, then I'm an individual within the creation. If I'm an individual within the creation, different from the creation, then I'm subject to birth and death and unhappiness, and I have to, you know. So everything with this knowledge, you can see, with this knowledge, absolutely everything changes. That's why in that Gita verse that we have, what is night to a jnani is day to an ajnani. What is day to an ajnani is night to a jnani. For a jnani, this whole, just think of it, to be able to see. It's not a belief, to be able to recognize and see, I am the whole. The myself, the self that I am is changeless. I am the one from whom all of this has come. And the self of all of it. To have the mind own that, right, is a lot different than being a jiva within it. It's a much, much different vision. You know? And so what's so extraordinary about being a jiva mukta, one who has knowledge, is that you are the whole and you're walking in it. Mm-hmm. Right? You are the whole, and yet you're a jiva walking through experiencing it. And from Krishna's standpoint as an avatar, you know, that those verses that he said, as Ishvara now, I've, you know, through my maya, I've taken this form. Yeah. But from my standpoint, so Krishna is talking, as Ishvara, I've taken this form. But from my standpoint, I know everything that has come before and everything that comes after, I know the whole. And then he says to Arjuna, that's why you and I are a little different. Because I'm an avatar, you're a jiva. But on another level, you are me. And then he said, and the one who recognizes that, remember everything that I've taught you, the one who recognizes that, that person is me, that person is free. Very beautiful. Let's stop there.
Om.
Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamadachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.
So I hear it clearly that desires desires outside of oneself, and I can see it sometimes. They clearly can't satisfy you. They're not. They come, and you already can see the moment you enjoy the desire. There's already the thought of like, yeah, but it's going to go.
Yeah.
And knowing that. And not having the maturity yet to be that, to be the the detachment.
Yeah.
Right. But for the very fact that that's the truth, there's a criticism that comes in here for me.
That's why, you know, when we were talking about the Karma Yoga, several verses ago in chapter 3, I think it was, when Krishna said, I'm talking about Karma Yoga, you also have to have Karma Yoga, that prasada buddhi, toward your ability to do that or not. Say you're practicing Karma Yoga, you've understood, you know, Krishna's taught it all, so he's taught Arjuna all of this, you know, and how to have that prasada buddhi, accepting everything as prasad from the Lord. It says, even your ability to do this or not, you have to accept as prasad from the Lord. So what that means, but what that means is that you want the final voice to be the final voice in the buddhi, to be the one who is kind. You know, like say, for instance, you see that your mind is getting all entangled and upset. And so just by habit, now you have a critical voice that comes in and says, oh, look at what you're doing, and blah, 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 all of that. Okay. Now what do we do? Because this is also a reaction. This is the way the mind is. This is how it's used to dealing with itself. So it's a critical voice. Now you have to have, the prasada buddhi has to go behind that voice. Right? Because that voice is not a prasada buddhi voice. That's not a kind voice. And
right,
so,
because it has certain qualities.
Yeah. It has attacking, mean qualities.
Definitely.
But it's also come for a reason. You know, it might have interjected. Like, say, for instance, in psychology, we'll say you had a very hostile, violent, angry father, always critical, always criticizing. Little child interjects that voice. And so, really, what we say is a child will interject, take in that voice to relieve the tension. You know, it'll just naturally talk like that. It's kind of protecting you. You know, because you don't have to wait. If that voice is already inside, criticizing everything you do, then the anxiety of waiting for the criticism is relieved.
Wow.
Isn't that intense?
Yeah.
So now, you need to get a go behind even that and accept that and talk kindly to that critical voice and say, no, it's all right. We're doing the best we can. And then, so that has to, you see what I mean? That, the Karma Yoga Buddhi, the kind one, has to always, you always come from that position. So if somebody else is coming up that's not that,
yeah,
then you have to be kind to that one too. You got it?
Yeah, but also that's not the ultimate authority either. Because,
which one?
Well, the critic, the overlooking critic, the monitor, you know, is it good or bad? Is it right or wrong? You're doing it right or you're doing it wrong?
Yeah, but
I think that really comes from the Christian tradition.
Yeah, and it does, but it's also been handed down by our parents who come from the Christian tradition. So one thing Swamiji used to talk about in child rearing when he was talking to, you know, the Indian community, and he'd say, you know, be very careful with your children in the use of the word no.
Huh.
Use it sparingly. Use it only when it's an important word, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And be sparing in words like I hate that. He said, just think about it. I hate those bananas. It's too big of a word, you know? So be conscious, because all for kids, of course, all of these things are interjected, you know? You know, thinking in these extreme ways, you know, that create extreme emotion also.
The interjection, it sounds like it's almost shy to
it's like it's like you swallow it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, your psyche swallows it. But say if you think of that, say you understand that psychology, really what you're understanding is how that works. It's all part of that order. Then the question is to see how that order, see what happened, like say for this critical voice, you can say, well, where did I get that from? That's understanding the order. Then you probably go back to your parents or your mother or your father and you see. And then that gives you some, you see the whole kind of picture. Right? And then you have an objectivity, and then you also know that, you know, hatred begets hatred, love begets love. That's, you know. And so if you hate that critical voice, it'll just hate you back.
Yeah.
Right? That's not going to work. Yeah. What it needs to be, it needs to be given some space and understanding. And also it helps to know that those critical voices like that are usually pretty well formed by the time you're 4 or 5.
Is that 4? 4?
4 or 5, when you're young. You interject these, you know, and then growing up, but you really interject them big time when you're little. You know, and then they're rattling away. Here you are, you know, 40 or 50, and there they are. They're still in operation.
Still running your life.
Yeah, but it's because the conscious mind hasn't come to save them.
Mm-hmm.
You have to go and save them. See them. Be in dialogue with them. Let them help them. Because they've interjected that. But imagine, say four years old. A four-year-old child in psyche, four-year-old psyche, has interjected the mean father, the violent father. Now this is and start talking like the violent father, repeating things that he says. This is a four-year-old psyche carrying this responsibility in order to relieve tension for you. And so now, 40 years later, 50 years later, that little one is doing the same thing. It's not an adult, you know. It's like a child in daddy's clothes or a child in mommy's clothes. It's not an adult. So when you can go and talk to that part and say, no, it's okay. You don't need to worry about this anymore. We don't have to be perfect.
And in the light of the knowledge of Vedanta, That becomes a different thing than trying to fix the ego.
That becomes a different... Here, what we're doing in that... See, there's so many beautiful levels here. One is getting your buddhi, where would they have the ego be identified with the buddhi instead of with the manas. The ego identified with the buddhi that has knowledge. And then that one is then helping the different parts of the mind that are in reaction or having trouble. This process is really karma yoga, internal karma yoga. It's bringing the upset parts, the unconscious parts, into letting them transform and become peaceful, right? And so now the buddhi itself is not having the things, the points of contention that are in the psyche resolve with care, with enough care and love and time. Those resolve. Then what happens is that your mind then is just naturally abiding. And that's natural for the mind because you've taken care of these, I'll call them children, you know, these hurts. You know, so they reunite with the buddhi or with the ego. And so the mind now isn't suffering from a lot of internal pain. And whatever internal pain is, not that we ever get completely over our traumas, but whatever internal pain is there is handleable because the buddhi knows how to be with it because of kindness. And we have the same way of learning how to deal with the world. We have to deal with the world with kindness. And sometimes we're not able to do that because a person or situation is really impinging upon my lack of vairagya in that given area to a point that I can't handle. But then that's the sadhana, right? Because in that area, you know, I haven't really assimilated my knowledge. I don't have trust. I lose trust in Ishwara. You know, I think I have to have this thing to be happy. I can't exist happily if this is how it's going to be. This person is ruining my life. I can't, it's bigger than me. That happens sometimes. Like that's a real sadhana. That issue is that when that happens, then that's a for real sadhana. Right? Because then you have to be able to do this objectification and bring your knowledge to it and sit with it. And not try to be a goody-goody. I don't mean anything. I mean really sit with it. Talking to the different parts inside, all the different ages inside to see who's really being devastated by this and why. And, you know, you have to work it through. And it's a wonderful thing to do, take that time to work through these things. It's just all part of letting your mind is going through a huge process of sorting out all of the traumas from beginningless lifetimes. Sorting it all out in light of your knowledge.
Oh, there's more than just
unwinding.
Yeah.
This one's good enough, Paul. But after, you know, there comes a period where that sorting out and working on yourself is, I mean, it's your life, really. And your mind isn't causing you much pain. And so that's all handleable, you know. But at first, when you first start gaining some clarity, you have to realize that your mind is just now coming out of samsara. You know, it's just now starting to recognize the truth of things. But all up to this time, it hadn't. It had been seeking and having little glimpses, like if, say, if you read something or somebody said something, you see it, you see a little glimpse here, but you don't have the whole picture. Mm-hmm. You know, and so it's had a hard time. And now it has to unwind all of that. It takes time. You know? but as it unwinds, it becomes more and more relaxed. And your buddhi, your knowledge, becomes stronger and stronger and stronger. You know, to be able to really hold that unwinding. And knowing what to do with all of these characters inside.
I don't want to get off track, but there was a phrase that you used in speaking tonight that really caught my ear. You said something about the desires that come from your prarabdha.
Yeah.
Can you just talk more about that? Because it's really a very big thing that desires come from your prarabdha.
Oh, yeah. What they say was that the prarabdha, first of all, what is it? It's the sanchitta, means the whole infinite bag of karmas that belong to you. Out of those, there's a group of them are fructifying now. They'll take you all the way through this life. That's the prarabdha. But in order for them to fructify, they have to manifest somehow, right? And so they say that manifests in three ways to move you. And one of the ways is anyecha, right? From another person draws you, or others draw you into a situation. Or anicca, it's the universe presents. It has nothing to do with a person. It's the universe presents, puts you in the situation. It's not somebody saying, come, you're just there because of the universe. You know, something that happens. Like a house burns down, a car accident, or something good, you know, positive or negative. The other one is swaicha. It comes out of your own desire to move forward, to do something. You know, and those desires are very natural to you. You almost don't even realize them as desires, in a sense. It's what you want to do, what you have to do. And they're a deep desire. You know, but they're very much an expression of who you are, and those desires are you, you know, and they present a situation in accordance with your prarabdha. And so it's not ever, you'll never be without desire. The difference is the desire of ajnani is, let me do the ajnani, the desire of an ajnani is, I want this so that I can be happy. For ajnani is, I want this. Not so that I can be happy. I already am happy. I already am whole and complete. But I want this. But so that's Ishwara. Right? It's Ishwara's desire. And it just manifests in the way... So you look at that. It's Ishwara's desire. It manifests in the way that it manifests. And I accept that manifestation as prasad from Ishwara. It's a prasad of buddhi. For Jnani, there is no kartritvam. I see the whole thing as Ishwara. Right? I see the desire as Ishwara. I see the result as Ishwara. I enjoy the whole thing as Ishwara. For a mumukshu, with a karma yoga buddhi, right? I can see the desire as Ishwara, and I go with the desire. I have some kartritvam there. That's the difference. The kartritvam is there. But I accept the result as with a prasada buddhi. As you see, you can go deeper than that where you understand the desire, because you're already full. You don't need a desire. The desire, you can feel the desire, it's your very prarabdha. So the desire is Ishwara and the result is Ishwara. The whole thing is Ishwara. I don't have that, I need this to be happy. That's the big difference. There's nothing wrong with desire unless it's binding, you know. Now these verses are beautiful that these next coming verses are talking about the difference between a desire that's binding and not binding. It's binding if it doesn't fulfill itself in the way that I've decided it has to. You know, I won't be happy. You know, I'm always having to call the shots about what is required for my happiness. That's a binding desire. What if I'm not interested? I don't have a desire to call the shots, but what I need to be happy. If that's the case, then life is interesting. Right? The situation, Ishwara, is interesting. Right? Because you're not at stake. Ishwara is not that interesting if you're at stake. The only thing that's interesting is what you want out of it, out of Ishwara. That becomes stressful. It's more stressful than interesting. Yeah. Is that
good? Yeah, I know. I heard the psychologist talk about working with like people who have gone through very serious traumas, and like, you know, being tortured in war. You know, monks from Tibet who've been through great trauma, and how they would meditate, and sometimes it was very disturbing because then some of these experiences would start to replay in their mind.
Mm-hmm.
So when I heard about that, I kind of, you know, I thought about it, and I was thinking, of course, I was thinking of my own meditation experiences, and that I wondered if sometimes my resistance to meditate, sometimes I'm resisting to meditate in that I've had experiences of reliving some kind of a trauma again, and not in a way that it felt like it was resolving,
mm-hmm.
but that it was reminding me of traumatic experience. But then I was wondering, maybe I wasn't actually meditating. Maybe I was just daydreaming or something else. I don't know.
But one of the things is, you know, with meditation, even in ancient India, they talk about what are the obstructions that can happen in meditation.
Mm-hmm.
One is just you get sleepy and fall asleep. One is the mind is restless. One is that you have some ananda experience and then you want more. Oh, look, you know. But one is what they call the kashayas, which are unconscious things bubbling up from the unconscious. And the reason that happens is because as your mind relaxes, it kind of sinks. You know, like the mind defense system loosens up. And that will release a lot of that. So how they taught this in India is a little different than we deal with it now. Because I think, as Jung would say, you know, they didn't have the type of traumatic material in the unconscious that maybe we have now. But how they would do it is just, if those things come up, then you just sit with it. You don't reject it. You are just interested in accepting and let it come up and go. You know? For us, we do that is fine if that's possible. But the other thing is, if you're going to let these kind of things come up and you've had a lot of terrible trauma in your life, then it's nice to have somebody to be with you to help you, like to have a therapist or somebody that you're working with that can give some support to the ego, to the consciousness, that, you know. But if it's enough for you, if you can deal with it, then you just have to learn how to deal with it. And the way to deal with it is to be a kind presence, like a good mother to that trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it isn't healing. What happens is, if there isn't that kind, loving presence that can hold it and be with it, you're just re-traumatizing yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's only if you have the ability to be objective and hold it in a kind and loving way. Like, say, if you have a little child who's crying her eyes out, you know, and so upset, what are you going to do? You'll hold your child and be with your child until the tears dry up and, you know, and then maybe she'll talk to you about it or just run off and play again. You have to be there. You have to be there as a strong, loving presence who will see it through. then that becomes the witness to the trauma. And then that part who's traumatized can heal. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, because I know from I work with some of my clients, a lot of times what happens with them if they're going through something really painful, there is nobody inside holding them. Mm-hmm. That's just it. That the pain and that they're suffering from, they're alone with it. Mm-hmm. Right? And so that is, and that can go on and repeat and repeat and repeat. It's just being re-traumatized. So now say you're not able to have that holding, then it's good to work with a therapist. Because what happens then is that the therapist becomes that witness, that holding witness, that gives some objectivity to it, and that is healing. And eventually the client or the person is able to interject that the witnessing holding of the therapist, kindness of the therapist. So that is sometimes necessary. Depends, you know, on what a person has been through.
You know, what's so interesting tonight is you talking about that. I mean, it really comes down to that kind voice in all these instances. You know,
internal and external.
Uh-huh. And if you're not hearing it, if you're not able, if that last voice isn't that voice, it's like there's a little more, a few more layers to get down in there. You know, got to get down to that voice.
Yeah. But the thing is, you know, as soon as the critical voice or hurtful voice is recognized, you can always come in with that voice. You have to recognize it.
Mm-hmm.
Because what happens is that critical voice can be there. You don't even realize it.
Mm-hmm.
You haven't become conscious of it. It just is. Mm-hmm. But once you become conscious, then you can go, oh, I see you. You know? And then you can help that voice.
It's like the ghost in the room or something. You know?
The mind is so, whatever the dynamics are in the mind, they've established themselves from a young age, and they're not used to being objectified. They're used to just being. But as soon as they're objectified, right, then they become something to be transformed or to be handled in one way or another. Right? You can do something because you've objectified them. But a lot of times they are objectifying you. In other words, they're the voice that's identified with the ego, the observing, what we call the observing ego. It's been overwhelmed by this voice, and what has to happen is that it has to be objectified. So just requires sitting with yourself. Sometimes that's why it's so good in meditation to just totally relax and sit with yourself and let whatever is there be there. Don't push it away or anything. Just be with it. But that, in that very act, you're totally with it, but you're also objectifying it because you're aware of it. You know? In the end, it's the kind voice. It's true.
What did you say?
In the end, it's the kind voice because it's the kindness. The kindness that brings Shanti. Your kindness. See, it does, because you're not going to make the world kind. But that's not what really brings the Shanti. The world can be so kind, but if you're not kind, you won't have Shanti.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Even the world, no matter what, they're so wonderful and kind. But if you're buddhi, is not kind, even inwardly, to the things going on inside of you, there won't be the Shanti. If the kindness is there, no matter what is going on, there's some Shanti that is present. Shanti is present to the hurt.
Mm-hmm.